Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The minutiae of the foreign exchange markets can be daunting, but when you think about the global economy, it doesn't much matter whether you're talking about a buck or a pound, because in the end, it's all about exchange rates, how much of one you can get for the other. If one side feels it's not getting enough, well, then you get trade disputes, and that's never good. So today, Beijing took the rare step of adjusting its currency. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices, calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 18th of May today, TGIF, everybody. It's great to have you here. The U.S. trade deficit with China last year hit an all-time high of 1.8 trillion yuan, about $232 billion at today's exchange rate. Imagine then that the yuan was worth just 0.5% more than it is, and what that might do to the balance of trade. Next week, a Chinese delegation will be in town to talk trade with Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. Today, they effectively took the UN off the agenda. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out what that really means.
Starting Monday, China's currency will be allowed to rise or fall 0.5% a day. It doesn't sound like much, but the limit used to be 0.3%. The U.S. and the European Union have been pressuring China to float its currency, but Cornell finance professor Warren Bailey says that could have serious consequences.
Suppose, for example, that they cut it loose and every Chinese citizen who has savings decides that they want to diversify outside China or they want to buy a house in Flushing or Monterey Park. If you see a lot of money being drawn from China to invest overseas, that could put pressure on the banking system.
In fact, China may be trying to do the opposite. The central bank announced today that it's raising interest rates and asking banks to put more money into reserves, both of which will make it more expensive to borrow money. University of Chicago professor Dolly Yang says China's trying hard to slow down its hyperactive economy and stock market. But it's also taking baby steps toward relinquishing control over the yuan, which could make it a candidate to be a foreign reserve currency like the dollar or euro.
If the Chinese yuan is freely convertible, it would immediately become potentially one of the reserve currencies. And that will dramatically increase China's standing in the global economy.
For now, though, the yuan's wider leeway may mean little. The Chinese currency has rarely even explored the limits of the current band. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Here's a story about the kind of information that helped put Martha Stewart behind bars. Inside results about the effectiveness of an important cancer drug from the biotech firm ImClone. This time, though, it'll be a lot tougher to zero in on the possible inside traders. You could say the list of suspects includes 24,000 physicians. And some analysts are convinced insiders are trading on the information. Here's Marketplace's Bob Moon.
There's no question in the mind of T. Rowe Price biotech analyst Jay Markowitz. He's sure the mysterious movements in a handful of pharmaceutical shares, significant ups and downs in their stock prices, are the result of clinical trial data that's supposed to be a secret. The American Society of Clinical Oncology sent confidential summaries, or abstracts, to ASCO members ahead of its conference on June 1st. Markowitz is urging the group to start being fair to those not privy to the information.
They have one of two choices, in my view, and that is to either release the abstracts to everyone, like most other medical meetings do, by providing the public access to them on their website, or releasing them to no one.
It's a little late for that second remedy in this case. The previews are already in the hands of 24,000 doctors. The head of the Foundation for Integrity and Responsibility in Medicine, Dr. Roy Poses, says this isn't just a question of business ethics. He sees no valid medical reason to limit release of the data.
You are doing a disservice to those patients who voluntarily consented to participate in the trial if you send out the information resulting from that trial in some sort of restricted manner. Because if it's going to advance science and healthcare, it should go to everybody who might be interested at the same time.
And Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, a former chair of ASCO's Ethics Committee, says patients should always come first, not stock trades.
In some ways, this makes me sad because it says that the policies of a professional medical organization should be determined primarily by what's happening on Wall Street.
ASCO told us it plans to review its policies for next year's meeting, quote, in consideration of this year's experience. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The Dow hit another record today. The S&P almost did. We'll have the details and a look at the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. Let's do a little market vocabulary for just a second here. We cover the equity markets a good deal on this program. It's just a fancy way of saying stocks. And mostly we talk about the public equity markets, companies whose shares are bought or sold on stock exchanges, whether that's in New York or London or even Shanghai. But you might have noticed another phrase creeping into the news, especially this week, private equity. Big buyout firms have been on a shopping spree, taking those public companies off the market. So we thought it might be time to look at what that means. Adam Leshinsky is a senior writer at Fortune magazine. Hey, Adam.
Hey, Kai.
Where's this money coming from that people are getting to finance all these deals, first of all? And then what happens when the good times are gone?
First of all, the money's coming from people like you and me and the people listening to this program. The buyout funds raise money from pension funds, from mutual funds, from wealthy people, from university endowments, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
They raise equity. They then borrow more money from banks and other lenders who can lend it because interest rates are historically low. And they then have an extremely large pool of money to put into buying assets that they think are undervalued for one reason or another.
All right. And so they've got all this money that they've borrowed. They've plowed it into these companies. What happens once the value of those companies perhaps isn't what it is today?
If the conditions change, then they won't be able to sell them for higher prices. So they will either sell them at a loss or they will go bankrupt and lose their money. So the question becomes, of course, who's holding the bag when that inevitable turn of events happens? Traditionally, the buyout firms who invested their equity simply will lose it, and they do from time to time. But more importantly, the banks who lend the money will be left holding the bag. And this time around, Kai, they're going to be holding it in an extremely unfortunate way because they've been so eager to make these loans because they get fees when they make the loans that they've been issuing the money with fewer restrictions than ever before in the buyout game.
How much sense can that possibly make, though, from the bank's point of view?
It doesn't make any sense from the bank's point of view, Kai. It's short-term thinking. And, you know, just as surely as we're reading about the banks that emphasized subprime loans, all of a sudden we'll see stories about massive losses at the banks who are making these kind of loans. And it's the same thing if you put ourselves back even further to the internet bubble back in 1999 and 2000. We knew how it was going to end. What we didn't know was when and how.
Okay, so let's try to figure it out, you and I. These banks make these loans. They don't get their repayments back. They're left holding the bag. What happens that day?
Well, assets get marked down all the time. And let's just go back to a house for a moment. You buy a house for $1 million. You have to sell it because you can't make your mortgage payments, but it's only worth $600,000. So you've lost your money.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you need to declare a personal bankruptcy, whatever. Somebody will buy it for $600,000 and they'll live there, or they'll sell it for $625,000. And similar things will happen. But eventually, if they don't make a profit on the investment and if they don't make a profit on many of their investments, and here's the key to the way they think, they won't be able to go out and raise another fund. And that means they have to go look for a job.
Unlike, you know, you and me, right?
We just keep going forever and ever. That's right.
That's right. Adam Leshinsky at Fortune Magazine up in San Francisco. Thanks, Adam. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you, Kai.
The Kingdom of Bhutan sits high in the Himalayan mountains. It's small, just 700,000 people or so, and historically withdrawn. It only allowed television and the internet in 8 years ago. The government even charges a tourist tax to make sure there aren't too many visitors. $200 a day, American money. But you can't say businessmen there don't dream big. A couple of weeks ago, Bhutan sent its first trade delegation to the world's biggest consumer market. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli has the story.
This winter, I volunteered at a new radio station in Bhutan. When I returned to the United States, I wrote a story for one of the papers back in Bhutan on my impressions of the media landscape there. A consultant here in Southern California read the story online and sleuthed me out to tell me about the first ever trade mission from Bhutan that was coming to L.A. Suddenly, I found myself dancing with a bunch of Bhutanese business people at a community center at a dinner in their honor. Despite the traditional dancing and cuisine, the hopes were distinctly modern.
Everyone comes here with a big dream, and I've come here with a big dream that somewhere we would strike it lucky, where we would reach out to the people and let us know what we are about.
That's Dechen Penjor. She owns a handicraft store in Bhutan's capital city of Thimphu. And like her counterparts on the trade mission, this would-be capitalist is guided by a devout Buddhist perspective.
Bhutan follows a middle path approach to development, which is the same in line with Buddha's teachings. Not too much modernization, not too less development, but in the middle.
That philosophy of moderation makes it hard to compete on the global stage. With fewer than 700,000 people and a rocky landmass the size of Switzerland, there's no way Bhutan can keep up with neighboring China or India. Still, the people of Bhutan are feeling the need to find new markets for their textiles, herbs, incense, and tea.
For many years, I think probably more than 90% of our trade was with India.
That's Sonam P. Wangdi. He's Bhutan's director of trade. He says Bhutan imports twice what it exports.
We have a problem and we need to resolve that. So we are interested in exploring all markets so that we have a larger portfolio of products going to more countries. So you're more diversified, protected from risk in any one particular market.
This is a critical time for Bhutan. After 100 years of monarchy, the country's preparing for its first democratic elections next year, and it's flirting with joining the World Trade Organization. What most everyone on the mission learned is that their first order of business is explaining where they are from. Kunzeng Dorji Thinley sells Bhutanese arts and crafts, and he felt resistance from buyers.
First, we need to advertise our country first, because when we bring the product, people do not know about Bhutan, no? So that's why it's having a little difficult time there. Yeah.
But even the group's organizers didn't expect to sell much on this trip. Consultant Grant Vinning has been prepping the delegation on how to do business in America. It's not quite the same back in Bhutan.
If everybody here has developed brochures, learned how to do their pitches, and we don't sell a damn thing, the point is, they themselves have changed. They're learning to do things far more professionally. So if you look at that changing of the culture objective, then yes, the project's been a success.
The changing of the culture is something the Bhutanese fear, even as they cautiously begin to step out. That's why they're moving slowly into this world of commerce. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
What's a Friday afternoon without the dulcet tones of David Johnson from Dallas, Texas? Mr. Johnson, how are you?
I'm just marvelous. You know, as long as the bowl stays around, not a good choice of words, probably.
Well,
as long
know,
as the upward momentum of the market continues, I'll continue to sling the bowl.
Well, what gives? I mean, you know, we just talked to Leshinsky a little bit ago, and we talked about this private equity stuff that's going on, but there were some serious deals this week.
Yeah, there were some serious deals, and they just keep on coming, and it's just... it's breathtaking, the money that's out there. I mean, the story is that GE is getting ready to sell its plastics unit. We knew that. They said that. And everybody figured it would be worth about like $8, $9 billion. Well, yeah. It looks like it's going to be worth $11 billion. And how about just this Microsoft deal that came out of the blue today?
Yeah. Now, we all know that Microsoft has a lot of money, but everything I've read says that they way overpay for this. Is this a question of Steve Ballmer and the gang up in Seattle having sort of more money than sense?
Yeah, but see, that's what's going on right now. It looks like everybody's got more money than sense. I don't know if they overpaid for it or not. I mean, that stock was a broken stock. It was a forgotten stock. If you look at their chart on them, and we're talking about a Quantive.
Yes.
But they're paying $6 billion for this thing. If you look, the chart, Kai, it's the neatest thing. If you look at the chart, it looks like the Grand Canyon. Okay? And so the price is way up high over here, then it drops like a rock, and then it goes sideways forever, and then along comes Microsoft today. But, you know, these poor bears can't go out and short a bad stock anymore. I can't sell bad stocks. Out of portfolios because these are the ones that are going
to
get bought out.
Well, that seems to be...
Oh, and the other one. Did you see the other one? Did you see? There are evidently 12 groups that are trying to buy Dr. Pepper.
Yeah, everybody wants to be a Pepper, right?
Exactly. $16 billion for that.
All right, now hang on. I want to back up to what you just said. Is it at all troubling to you as a professional in the business that you can't get rid of a bad stock? You can't short it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it's very strange, and it doesn't go on forever. And when it ends very badly. But for right now, it's just marvelous. We've talked to we're blue in the face about corporate earnings, and the corporate earnings are good, and they've been increasing. And there's this real dichotomy in the market. They're buying the blue chip stocks. We've seen the Dow Jones Industrials average go up, 30 the last 36 sessions at a new all-time high today.
Yeah,
and, you know, just as a sidebar, the S&P average still isn't there. Of course, the NASDAQ probably never will make another new all-time high. But the S&P isn't, and it's close. It's close, but still hadn't made a new one. And that really just goes to show you how bad, it reinforces how bad that technology breakdown was. Because there are more technology stocks in the S&P than there are in the Dow. And so it's been harder for it to recover from the horribleness that took place in the year 2000. It was ugly.
And yet we move on. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Good to talk to you, Kai. Have a good weekend.
And enjoy yourself the same. Pay attention now because coming up there's going to be a test. English only, please.
What is your name?
My name is Aripe.
Are you carrying any weapons today?
No.
Are you sure?
Yes.
But first, let's do the numbers. Back to the broken record on Wall Street, on Wall Street, on Wall Street. Try not to yawn, but it happened again today. The Dow closed the week at a new high, 13,556. That was a gain of 79 points, around one-half of 1%. The NASDAQ climbed 19 points, three-quarters of a percent, to finish at 2558. The S&P 500 rose an even 10.00 points, two-thirds of 1%, wrapped up the week at 1522. For the week, the Dow Industrials climbed 1.7%, but it was hardly a sterling week for the tech-heavy NASDAQ, which lost two-tenths of a percent. The broader S&P 500 grew by 1.1%. A series of analyst upgrades helped boost the Dow today. IBM stock surged 2.5%. Intel shares were up 2.1%. ExxonMobil stock spurted up 1.8%. And stock in Verizon picked up 1.1% as well. Overseas, European stock markets capped the week with strong gains. London's FTSE kicked up nearly 1%. The Paris CAC 40 advanced 1.25%. Bond prices dropped. That pushed the yield on the 10-year Treasury note up to 4.8%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Waitress, a comedy about a diner waitress who finds inspiration in motherhood, friendship, and pies. In select theaters now. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Monday. The Energy Information Administration releases forecasts of world energy supply and demand through 2030. Pulitzer Prizes are awarded at a ceremony at Columbia University. And a North Dakota trade delegation heads to Cuba to discuss a $20 million purchase agreement. The state regularly exports dry beans, peas, and lentils to Cuba. This time, the delegation will be pushing potatoes. I'm Jane Lindholm.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The big TV network spent the week pitching their fall schedules to advertisers. Viewers will be fed a diet of crime dramas and science fiction thrillers, some reality shows, and a couple of sitcoms. But commentator and actor Mike Farrell says television isn't taking advantage of some very real material.
I was lucky to be part of TV's MASH, a show that made hundreds of millions of dollars for 20th Century Fox and CBS while exposing the horror of war through the stories of war in Korea. But of course, as everyone understood, we were really talking about war in Vietnam and elsewhere. So what's happened to television? Where are today's Gene Reynolds and Larry Gelbarts? Where are people of principle willing to use their creative talents to remind us that blood is not spilled without cost? Today, as bodies are rent asunder in Iraq and our wounded lie in their own waste in veterans' hospitals, where are the satirists and dramatists willing to vent their outrage as the young fight and die for a political agenda dressed in lies about impending mushroom clouds? Why is the tube reduced to telling us that reality is needy people humiliating themselves to become stars? Clearly, it's about money. Cable made such an incursion that network executives have abdicated all responsibility to their audience. But it comes at a cost. Billions of dollars that could be better spent or wasted in Iraq, devastating a centuries-old region that once, it's said, contained the Garden of Eden, while more billions are wasted at home producing mindless television that dumbs down the audience, destroying its ability to tell entertainment from insult. The few gems that remain, bless them for persevering, only remind us of what's been lost. So how do we get it back? Well, turn the tube off in disgust. Create panic in the suites. Throw the money changers out of the temple, again. Let talent and principle resuscitate the most powerful technology ever developed with stories that ennoble and inspire. There was once a MASH. There can be again.
Actor and activist Mike Farrell is the author of Just Call Me Mike. That's his memoir. You can share your thoughts with us online. Our website's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. English might not be the prettiest language in the world, but it's music to the ears of South Koreans. They see fluency in it as an essential business skill. A high score on English tests can mean higher pay or faster promotions. It can also get you into an American university, which many South Koreans believe is the ticket to a good job. And so the result? English mania. We sent Rico Galliano on a little trip to check it out.
I'm standing at Stonehenge. Not the real one, this one's fake, and I think bigger. And it's in Paju City, an hour from Seoul in Gyeonggi Province. Busloads of second graders clamber around it, looking adorable in matching red sweatshirts. On a nearby hillside, spelled out in huge letters like the Hollywood sign, are the words English Village. This is the entrance to a $90 million experiment, the most unusual language academy on Earth. See, this English village, also known as Paju Camp, is designed to look like England. There's a bright red tram, student dorms modeled after Britain's Eton Prep School, traditional British cobblestone streets, undergoing some traditional British repaving there, and, of course, a place to get traditionally Britishly drunk.
Oh, and here we are in front of the double-decker English pub and brewery. Here it is. Can I get a beer in there?
Yes, of course.
The whole 69-acre village is like Oxford by way of Disneyland. Imagine living and working here.
My name is Jessica Lofbaum. I'm a teacher here at English Village. I'm from the USA. It's really bizarre. Sometimes we joke that we don't actually live in Korea. And so sometimes people who've, you know, finished their contract, they say, oh, I'm going to go work in Korea now.
That idea of a country within a country is exactly the point. Yunjin Lee is an education manager at Paju Camp. She says thousands of Koreans take their kids to actual England, or the U.S. or Canada, to immerse them in English, sometimes for years. That's a problem.
In Korea, if you're rich, you can offer better English education environment to your children. You can send them outside of Korea to learn English only. That divides Korea more deeply by money or class.
She calls it the English divide. Publicly funded Paju Camp is supposed to bridge that gap by transporting Koreans to a Western land right in their own backyard, for cheap. The teachers live here, but for students, a stay lasts anywhere from a day to a few weeks. And like any foreign trip, it starts at an immigration checkpoint. These middle school students even get fake passports, which I was somehow enlisted to stamp.
Do you mind asking them these questions?
Okay. What is your name?
My name is Ara Kim.
What is the purpose of your visit?
English study. Study English.
Good job. I'm going to stamp your passport.
You can ask other questions.
Really?
Yeah, whatever you want.
What is your name?
My name is Aripe.
Are you carrying any weapons today?
No.
Are you sure?
Yes.
I had her detained. No, not really. Instead, I conversed with other English Village denizens, including their mascot, Linky, a guy in a giant pink bunny suit.
My name is Linky.
Hello. Do you speak English?
I don't very well.
Do you think that's a little odd that the mascot of the English Village does not speak English?
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Now, I should say that Linky, like Mickey Mouse at Disneyland, isn't supposed to speak much. But most of the students I met were only a bit more fluent than Linky. The two exceptions to the rule told a familiar story.
How did you get so good at English?
I went to Canada for 2.5 years.
I went to England when I was 7 years old.
So is Paju Camp really narrowing the English divide? They've conducted surveys to find out, but the results aren't in. Meanwhile, 40 South Korean cities are planning English villages of their own. And I must admit, if Paju campers aren't always fluent, they do demonstrate a surprising vocabulary. Hear that? Stalker? I asked my interpreter to translate.
If you come to the English village as a new teacher, then she will probably end up being your stalker.
You would be a stalker? Where did you learn the word stalker?
At a loss for words in Paju City, South Korea, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
감사합니다.
Rico posted some pictures of his travels on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, some real-life treasure hunters announced a record find today. $500 million worth of sunken booty found somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean, most of it in the form of about 500,000 colonial-era gold and silver coins. Collectors are expected to spend $1,000 on average for each of those coins. The treasure hunting firm Odyssey Marine Exploration was silent about where the wreck is, or for that matter, its name and nationality. They did say they're going back for more. Investors, too. Shares in Odyssey were up 80% today. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday. Today, the Dow gained 79 points, almost 0.6%. Yes, another record. The NASDAQ rose 19 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 picked up 10 points on the nose, 0.2%. That, by the way, is within 5 points of a record closing high. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, a hard lesson in business.
There are two kinds of people in the world. The first kind, entrepreneurs, dreamers who will bootstrap a company from nothing in the hopes of a distant payday. And the second, well, everybody else.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.